I'm economizing on potions, I know.
If I drop it, it isn't my fault. We did a little last week about a triangle of relations, and we wanted to know why we hadn't done it before. And the answer, of course, must have been because we were busy doing something else. And this week we'll have a look at it. This triangle of relation has been used for a few thousand years, and it has been reworded periodically to bring it up to date. It is tremendously important. Karl Marx uses it, Hegel used it, Plato used it. The idea, basically, is that you have an observer looking down at two entities, A and B, and he's looking for something similar in A and B, intending to relate A and B by the similar he discovers. This particular symbol, the triangle with the eye over it, appears on the back of an American dollar, actually, where the triangle is disguised as a pyramid, the symbol of hierarchical power, the invert symbol of democracy. Every A and B, if relatable, must have something in common. If they have nothing in common, they cannot be related, and if they cannot be related at all, then there cannot be one observer. There would have to be an observer of A and an observer of B. And if there were no factor in A like B, A and B could not act upon each other, and therefore if there were two observers, one A and one B, the two observers could not communicate. So if communication is possible, it implies an identity of some order between the different parts of reality. Well, that's the original form of the glyph. We'll now draw it again. We will put on the top here reality and affinity and communication. I'll shorten it by two hours. Now the statement is made by most epistemologists that reality is simply the agreement of observers. For instance, I've drawn a triangle. If I say, is this a real triangle? I'm really saying, in shorthand form, do the sense organs of all the observers in this room perceive that which we mean by triangle? If there is an observer in the room who cannot see here three lines joined together in the manner that we call shortly a triangle, if there is somebody in the room who can't see it and sees instead a very beautiful advertisement for somebody's soap, then he will say that this is not real. We have said there is a triangle here. If he doesn't see one, he will say it is not really so for him. If we all agree that there is a triangle there, we will agree to use the word reality of this triangle. If there is anything in the universe at all that appears differently to every being, then it must have as many realities as there are beings perceiving it. We will accept this definition, then, that reality is simply the congruence of perception of all beings. So if we look into the universe and agree that there is a universe, what is happening in fact is that we are seeing stars in the sky, moon, planets, sun, aeroplanes, and so on. And if, when required to examine these things, our sense organs give us the same formal data, then we agree to call it real. Now, in order for us to perceive a reality and agree about it, then the observers of this reality must have something in common. We'll put down here two observers, A and B. If they agree on this reality, by our first law, that there must be an identity between A and B if they are to communicate, then A and B, if they agree upon the nature of the perceived reality, must have a natural affinity. That is to say, they must be formally, substantially identical if they are to perceive the same reality. Now, if they wish to convey to each other the fact that they are perceiving the same reality, they must communicate. And again, to communicate from A to B implies that there is something in A like something in B, so that B can respond to a stimulus from A. And if B is to reply, there must be something in A like something in B, so that B can stimulate A. So we see here that reality, again, implies the identity of beings, and affinity requires the identity of beings, and communication requires the identity of beings. When we look at this triangle, then, we see we're really concerned with identity of being. Communication is possible because there is identity of being. Affinity is actually the statement there is identity of being, and reality is the perceived identity of being. Now there's an old statement that says, if we lift up one point of the triangle, we necessarily lift up the other two. This is very important for human relations. We look into the world and we agree that we have seen, in this case, a triangle. We agree on this, and the agreement establishes reality. If we see a triangle here, it proves something not only about the nature of the triangle drawn on the paper, it proves something about the perceptive organs of the people viewing it. Those perceptive organs must be of the same order, must function on the same level. If I get a tiny insect whose angle of vision may cover perhaps a 1/16 of an inch and put it inside this triangle, it cannot judge that it is a triangle because its angle of vision is too small to cover it. So for that little insect, if I were to talk to it in basic Esperanto and say you are standing in the middle of a triangle, it would not know. It would have to take my word on authority or reject it, believing that really there's no point of communication because there is no affinity. The fact that we can agree that we have drawn a line and another and made a triangle, therefore, says something not only about the thing drawn, but about the perceivers of the thing drawn. All perceivers at the same level of being perceive the same reality when presented with the same stimuli. They can communicate what they have seen only because they are fundamentally identical. If then we wish to increase communication between two beings, we must find an affinity, that is, a similarity, an identity in our being. We must look for something that we have in common with the other beings. This is basic in educational theory. We go from the known to the unknown. We first say, do you know X? He says, yes, I know X. Then you say, well, X equals Y. And then you communicate Y by making an equation. If you can show that Y is identical with X, then you have communicated Y by starting with X. You go from the known to the unknown. So you go from a known affinity to the possibility of communication. And then, if the person receiving that communicated element, that stimulus, accepts it and checks back with you, then you establish a reality common to both of you. Because every time you can discover some point of affinity between yourself and another being, you have done two things at the same time. You have increased your capacity for communication and you have raised your level of reality. On the other hand, if you couldn't find a point of affinity inside yourselves and you wish to increase communication, you then look into the world of reality, the world of sense phenomena, and you indicate a given thing, X, and say, can you see X? If he says, yes, I can see X, you have established some communication and shown an affinity. So again, we have an easy mode of lifting the general level. the indicator reality when we cannot find any point of communication because we can't find any affinity. If, on the other hand, we want to raise the level of reality and we have an affinity, all we have to do is communicate that affinity. If we are in communication and can see some facts, and we want to increase our affinity, we state the facts that we can see, we communicate them, and agree that we have seen the same facts, and thus establish an affinity. Let's take an example in the case of the problem with the Calabar, which has been cropping up in the last couple of years fairly strongly. A theory has said that white men and black men are not the same. That is, they have no affinity, essentially. We point to the reality of the fact and say, well, they are bipeds, and they do show a certain capacity for rational activity. They can drive motor cars, fly aeroplanes, run about, do various deeds that white men can do. So by looking at the reality, the factual reality, we can indicate affinities, and that raises a level of communication. We can point out a basic one. If the black and the white people were totally dissimilar, then they could not breed together. The fact that they can breed together shows they have an affinity, a biological affinity. So then communication, being established, they produce progeny in the act of communing, shows that they have a basic affinity in the factors of heredity. And this establishes that reality includes these two as equivalents at that level. If we understand clearly this, we can begin to put it into operation in any real situation. If we state the elements in the situation to each other, we are communicating and establishing at that moment that there is an affinity between us. If, when we are in communication, we wish to raise our level of reality, we must indicate those things that we agree about, that is, our affinities. And if we have actually felt an affinity, we can, by communicating the elements of the affinity, lift up our level of reality. So we say, to lift up one point of this triangle is to lift up the other two. Now, supposing you are having a row with somebody, a disagreement. Now, a disagreement means you are pretending that the affinity is not what it ought to be. And consequently, there is a lack of communication. If there is no affinity and there is a lack of communication, there is a non-agreement about the nature of reality. So that if you have a very vigorous argument with someone and you have no affinity of terms, you cannot communicate your mental content, and you begin to become unreal to each other. This is one of the most important aspects of it. If a man is arguing with his wife, he starts off by assuming that he is somehow different from her, and she assumes she's different from him. They then start firing statements across the table at each other, and by careful disagreement they prove that there is no communication. And at this moment, wife, he says, you are becoming unreal to me. Meaning the communication affinity level has gone down. We find this quite a lot in psychological practice, that the patient says, things are becoming unreal. Nothing seems real to me anymore. This simply means that in their attempt to communicate, they have not found points of affinity with other beings, and therefore their reality, which depends on communication of affinities, has gone down. So we have to then devise a method of proving that they have got affinity with other beings, and then we have to devise a symbology, a language, whereby their affinity can be communicated, and by discovering affinities and then communicating, we begin to travel up and become progressively more real. It's a very widely spread fact that the sense of unreality arises from failure to communicate or to discover affinities. Have we any dealt with before?
okay, that's a totally unreal approach to life.
That's very good. Here are two people. There's the Center of Imminent Spirit Initiative. Here's the Five Sense Life in both of them. Here's the Intellectual Life in both of them. And the fact that we can concentrate on any one of these levels can make us relatively unreal to each other. You said, Bert, an introvert. An introvert is a fellow who is cutting down on the messages from outside, reducing their intensity, and he is beginning to move inside. Now, you mentioned probably in the pathological sense, and therefore you did not mean a positive intellect preoccupied with the pursuit of yoga. So he has gone so far in, but not so far in that he discovers his pure intellect. He is therefore at a level where the memory impressions of previous sense stimuli are dominating his consciousness. So when he refers to anything, he is not referring to the external situation, he is referring to some mnemic situation from his past experience. Now, if he acts as if what he is talking about is real to him, and as a defined introvert of that order, he must do so, he will be talking individually and subjectively about his own inner states. So if you show him a certain kind of picture, he will say, I don't like that picture. And he's thinking, I don't like that picture because it's got the Andrew cross in it, and that cross means action, conflict, cross, swords. He's telling you something about his own inner state. Another man who is extroverted, trying to communicate with him by referring to a given fact about X in algebra, not meaning the same thing, cannot communicate. He sends a message saying, concentrate X. But the introvert says X means an undesirable conflict. So the extrovert then says, this man is unreal. And this introvert is saying, this outside fellow, this extrovert, is also unreal. He doesn't know what I'm talking about or thinking about. So if we want to establish the communication and raise these, then the term extrovert-introvert can be employed. Jung used them in this sense and made some modification of psychological theory. We have to be very careful with them if we simplify the diagram a little. Say we can have men whose energy flows out and men whose energy flows in. If we state this as a fact and remember to say to each other, are you extroverting on the physical world at the moment, or are you investigating some of your private fantasies? There's a rule in Brahmanism that says, thou shalt not marry a red-headed woman. Now, you might go out and find a red-headed woman being very kind to children crossing the road. And you might say, well, there's kindness, I would like to marry kindness. If you were to investigate her motive for doing so, you might change your mind. You might not. If you're clear about what you're looking at, and you make the other fellow look at the same thing, then you can establish communication. Because again, you have a coincidence, and therefore reality appears. Where you can make this coincidence of sense percepts. If you know a man to be introverted, and you go the right artist and explain to him that he is introverted, and better to avoid the technical term, because now there's an unpleasant sense of it, a sense of negativity, so you're a man of deep meditative powers. And then you say, now will you please meditate on this external fact? That avoids the negative suggestion of calling him a so-and-so introvert. If, on the other hand, you're coming up against an extrovert who insists that there are no realities at all other than external objects, the occasions of sense stimuli, then you require him to introvert himself and see if it is not true that he has sensations in his body that do not divide, nor ever did derive from his five sense organs. We start life as an egg, and this egg has originally, apart from the nuclear hereditaments, no parts. If it is stimulated in that stage, away it goes through its substance, and we call this total reaction a photopathic reaction, which is non-discriminate. It responds to touch, taste, smell, sight, and sound indiscriminately. Every human being has been such an egg and has gone through various stages, and it has always been a sentient substance. This means that prior to the development and separation out of our five sense organs, we have already got data inside us, and these constitute our basic feelings and feeling attitudes, non-analyzed. Now later on there will be the construction of five special sense organs, and these, when stimulated, will give you confined reactions to specific frequencies and the total spectrum of the universe, audio frequencies, video frequencies, and so on. But between each two senses there is a large amount of tissue, not specialized but still responding. This means to say there is still inside us irrational, sub-rational feeling response to stimuli, and the five special sense organs are trying to tyrannize over this protopathic level. But the protopathic level is very, very old, and it cannot be eliminated by special sense organs, because special sense organs are just little localized zones that have been evolved to a very high degree of formal complexity, but they have not involved the tissue between. So you cannot eliminate protopathic responses. So again, in considering the triangle of relation, we can say to a man who is aware of his sense organs and thinks that only the messages of the special senses are real, we can require him to admit this fact, that he has in his body many, many thousands of cells, not in the five special sense organs, that these cells respond to stimuli, and that from them arise pleasant and unpleasant sensations. And when we get him to accept this fact, again we raise the reality level. We can, by so doing, help him to see that he can have attitudes, sub-rational, of liking and disliking towards any situation, person or stimulus there is. In the same way, inside him he has the principle of pure reason, the either-or function, and we can refer directly to the principle of pure reason, that between a symbol A and another symbol different to it, to justify the use of two different symbols, we must refer to two different entities. And this is the basis of our intellect. We say that A is not A. And by so doing we build up a logical structure that is quite independent of the five sense organs. Now many a time we will find that people, in trying to communicate, do not bother to discover their affinities. One can be working on the empirical sense level of the five sense organs, and he can be coordinating on the pentagon here those five sense messages, and thus making an empirical, statistical statement of reality. That is the kind of statement that a positivist would make, or a pragmatist, but it is not the kind of statement that a Platonist philosopher would make. A Platonist philosopher would say there is this pure logic, quite independently of the five special sense organs, and in fact predating them in the evolutionary sense, and actually constituting the mode of motion of absolute power. So if you then refer to what the man is saying, he's trying to communicate, and you say to him, are you talking from your five sense data, or are you talking from the level of pure reason, the six-pointed star? If you ask him to say this, and he thinks of it, he will then, we hope, know which level he's talking from. And if he does know, again you find points of communication. And remember, through identification with different levels of being, we actually find much disagreement amongst thinkers, even in the field of science, there are men who do not accept as science anything, whatever, except that which can be verified by the five sense organs. And there are others more thoroughgoing who deny that we can even establish the existence of sense organs, and simply say we must concern ourselves with sense data. And there are others that say we can't even call them sense data, we must call them events in consciousness. Now all this confusion arises from a lack of definition of the level from which you are talking. You can talk from your five special sense organs validly. You can talk from the interspaces between them, where your feelings are sub-rational but not thereby invalid. You can talk from pure logic, the either-or, or you can talk from the coordination of your five sense data in that structure called the common sense. But if you omit to say from what level you are talking when you are talking with another person, then you are likely to be at cross purposes. If you go to a spiritualist seance and talk to a female medium, she knows that she is talking from a sub-rational level, from something in between the special five sense organs, and she has a feeling. If she's a good medium, she has faith in this feeling, because if she hasn't got faith, it stops working. Because if she hasn't got faith, it means she's shifted her attention into a part of the mind which acts as a critical sensor of this prototypic reaction. This is why in yoga, if you want to become whole, you have to become prototypic. And if you want to become prototypic, you must cut down on the mechanical judgments arising from the stimulation of your five sense organs. Now remember that the prototypic level is the next level, the highest level of the individual, to the absolute level represented by the paper itself. Let the paper represent the absolute and the modal function of the paper, the way it moves, draws a circle. And thus that circle is a vibration of the paper itself. Now the movements of the paper through it totally are the prototypic reactions of the individual. And they are total and they are whole. They are not analyzed, they are pre-analytic and therefore not synthetic. In a synthetic structure in the mind, you have first broken down the seamless reality by analysis, and then you add together the analyzed elements. So synthetic thinking aims at a whole of related parts, the parts having previously been analyzed, whereas in the prototypic stage, you are experiencing directly through feeling a pre-analytic awareness of your own being. That pre-analytic awareness is only one stage different from the absolute, and it corresponds with the cosmic soul of the ancients, that anima mundi. And by practicing, cutting down on the special sense data and their mnemic residual traces and their judgments assessed in the common sense, and then by cutting down on the logic of either or, one comes then to the prototypic whole awareness, and this whole awareness itself has these five sense organs within it and all the mnemic data on top of, superimposed on this prototypic level, and then you become aware of the totality of your being. And in that state of equilibrated power of the whole, it becomes possible for there to emerge from the center of your being the awareness of your source in the absolute.
Isn't that case intuition prototypic?
Now you've introduced the word intuition. You can, if you like, use it in the technical sense, where philosophically intuitive knowledge is knowledge gained immediately without a sense organ. Now this will bring it into a very, very similar level to the prototypic one we have discussed. Now prototypic reactions have been demoted by biologists. This, you see, the amoeba and one that's about, and it reacts prototypically to a stimulus. But because it is very sluggish and it's at our mercy, we tend to scorn it. yet at its own level it is aware of itself in its medium as not two. It doesn't feel that it is totally separated from its medium, so that its life is in a sense confluent with the medium in which it lives. So if there is a chemical content in the water in which it lives, it feels and knows and responds to that as to its own being, because that water of its element constitutes its very being. So it knows its environment perfectly. Now later on the mono cell begins to develop some other functions, and by gradual specialization of pigment it will grow eyes which are extra sensitive to light. Now the amoeba is already sensitive to light, but not extra sensitive, they're not supersessed on it. But when the supersess is put on and eyes appear, then the being reacts to a light stimulus that comes from beyond its own environment, from beyond the level of the water line. And at that moment it can get out of phase with its own existence. If you respond to a stimulus from beyond your general level of awareness, it can put you out of gear with the environment in which you live. That's if you go to a political meeting with right-wing sympathies and you discover that the talker in that meeting is extreme left-wing, and you try to assimilate his ideas, when you go back to your conservative friends, they'll think you've been influenced. You have put yourself out of phase with your previous environment by opening yourself to a statement from another environment. Let's take the life of the fish as a type of being that is aware of all the behavior of the water in which it lives. If you go into that mysterious place called the Tower of Blackpool, there's an aquarium there, and you will see a tank full of fish which are blind. And there are many of these fish in the tank, and although they are blind and swimming about very quickly, they do not collide. Why do they not collide? Because every time a fish moves, the water moves around it. So that another fish here can feel by the movement of the water the proximity of another fish. So they are living in an element, and the movements of the element in which they live are the things to which they are responding, and therefore there is no collision. Notice there's no contingent relation there. It's analogous to field awareness. And the same way, if we take a dicky bird, which is a bit like a fish and the bee come in, this bird is very, very sensitive to air currents and to various fields in the air, and it can respond to air like the fish responds to water and its vibration. There have been a lot of experiments done by tying magnets under the wings of birds to test migration and so on. The fact is that as the fish responds to the movements of water, and the inner life of the fish is therefore a reflex of its environmental stimuli, so the life of the bird is internally one with the movements of the air in which it lives. Now, a man should live in another medium which we should not draw. We will say the natural environment of a fish is water, and of a bird is air, and of man is spirit, in its real sense. A man who is aware that there is a continuous power moving through all beings, if he can become aware of that power in the same way that the fish is aware of the movements of water, he can feel within that the movements that surround the fields of power of another human being, like one fish feels the movement of another fish through the movement of the water. If you change your mind about something, change your attitude about something, you have tuned yourself in. If you believe that there is a power field, and that you are modalities of that field, and that just as the fish can feel the water and the bird the air, so a man can feel this absolute field. When you believe that and start feeling for it, you will then begin to feel movements in the space around you, which movements, properly felt and evaluated, will convey to you information about other human beings with whom you're in proximity, just as those fish get information. So we then have modes of evaluating each other's reactions
of lifting up the reality level by discovering affinities and communicating the affinities, and we need this mnemonic device to remind us, to say, are you on the level of the physical, the gross matter? Are you on the level of the feeling, the water life like the fish, or the air life like the bird? That would be the ideal life. Or on the spiritual life like the man. And if you state clearly from what level you are talking, you can require the other person to go on to the same level in order to communicate. Or if he refuses to go on to the same level, to know that he is refusing. And thus at least you're proving some kind of reality, if only the reality of his refusal. And you can agree, if he won't go on to another level, to come on to his level instead, called beating him on his own ground. Because as long as you can establish an increase of affinity, a greater number of points in common, you have raised your communication possibility with him, and in so doing, raised the reality appreciation of both of you. And if all the beings in the universe were to agree about terms and agree about the perceptions they have, then they would agree about the total nature of reality.
When you speak of intuition being the same as prototypic immediacy, and you talk about higher intellect, which I take it to mean geometric counting by that, really, is that so? That the, when you're using logic of the higher intellect,
yes.
It is geometrical counting.
Yes, you're talking about the geometry of motion.
Yes. But that is not the same as intuition.
Well, here again, we've said that intuition, defined by the philosophers, is immediate awareness.
What I wanted to ask is the counting of the higher intellect in order to analyze the immediate intuition, or isn't that necessary?
No, it is a separate activity.
A separate
you would
activity.
Only use that if you wish to write a philosophy of immediacy. Remember, philosophy is concerned with a rational presentation, a worked out theory of something, and it must be rationally presented. Now, immediacy, in its proper sense, is that this paper is aware of itself, not through something else. Whereas the relation of perception in a mediated one is that you assume that there is an intelligence there, and an intelligence there, and that this intelligence cannot communicate directly with the other, but it has to communicate across the substance which he must vibrate. And that substance itself is modifying the impulse that he's sending out, and therefore falsifying it. Therefore, every mediated stimulus is false, to some extent. And the only immediate experience is that of the absolute itself by itself. But in our illustration here, the paper knows that it is paper, and it knows that it is moving. That is immediacy. Whereas a mediated way, there is a communication of a force from one place to another across an interfering medium, and the medium distorts it. You get this if you try to translate a poem from one language to another. The man has experienced something in German. That means to say that the spirit, working through a Germanic education, has selected for itself certain Germanic terms to express its experience. It then posits a German poem there on paper. Along comes a bilingual expert who unfortunately learned English first, so that all his experiences have been filtered through an English vocabulary. So he has selected English words to express what he means. He now, with a second language, namely German, first thinks in English, then translates roughly by reference to the external world, the real world, what the approximate German word is. He gets the poem. If he finds that word, he then looks for the corresponding English word, and of course it hasn't got the same rhythm or the same rhyme. And he then produces a verse which he calls a translation of the original poem. Now, as we showed before, every time you change your feeling you change your function, you change your form, you change the vowel and consonant structure which expresses it. So that a poem, if it is a real poem, is the exact objectification at the sonic level of an inner experience. If you try to translate this from one language to another, it is literally impossible. And the attempt to do so forces the experience, which is a matter of immanent spirit, across the mediating substance of the body through two different symbologies, and the result is distortion of a very, very high order. So that in fact, if you take even quite a simple German poem, one over the complex thought, say one by Heine, and translate the thing into English, it is not the same poem translated, it is another poem set up by the translator with profound and colossal nerve and defined as a translation when it isn't. Because it is impossible to translate in poetry, real poetry, because poetry is the objective expression at the sonic level of a valid immediate experience. And you reduce it to the mediated level when you try to translate it. Really, it's a question of the same thing we said before. You must say from what level you're talking. And the best thing for a person who wants to appreciate a poem in another language, or even a very deep philosophical thesis, is just to go and learn the language. I know a particular German who's been learning English for 35 years. And he's been learning it because he wants to be able to think in English. He has recently said that he thinks now that he can think in English. But it requires a tremendous amount of work. It really means that he must displace the education he had for his first 23 years and set up a symbology closer to his essence, and thus displace the one that was originally placed there. In so doing, he actually becomes an Englishman, because he then becomes completely conditioned by the concepts that traditionally have embodied themselves in the English language.
So the musician, in that case, has a far better chance of communicating his experiences to the world in general than the poet.
Yes, because his experiences are more generalized. And what he communicates certainly communicates better, but precisely what he's communicated is very hard to determine. Does he communicate more than a mood? More than a mood of significance. If you see the proper study of mankind is man, the same by Pope, is a concrete statement, and it says what it means. But supposing you get a series of notes by Beethoven and some chord structures moving in a certain way, and you get a tremendous feeling that something's got to be done. Is this exactly the same thing as saying the proper study of mankind is man? Or is it something so universal that it becomes almost useless for any specific purpose? It may not be almost useless, it might be completely useless. It might be quite useful, like a military march. See, the fact that man has two legs is the cause of the time of military marches. If you tried to march to war in Wolf's time, you would miss the third leg. There is a significance in music, but it isn't of the same order as the significance in literature and poetry. It's of a wider order and therefore less applicable in a certain sense. It lifts people out of the particular, which is why the ancient church, priests and so on were very fond of it. It lifts people out of the particular and makes them aware of larger issues, but it does not say what those issues are. Hence the accusation against priestcraft by left-wingers, who say that the use of incense and church music lifts an individual out of his individuality and then leaves him suspended and at the mercy of the next command of the officiating priest. Again, you have to say at what level you're communicating. Many a young fellow and girl have gone and listened to to some beautiful music and shed a tear, probably Tchaikovsky or something, which causes tears very, very easily. And when they have felt this identical emotion, they have assumed, quite rightly, that there is some affinity in them. And then they have assumed, quite wrongly, that because of this affinity, therefore they should dedicate themselves together forever. But that's a misinterpretation of the fact of the affinity they felt. So that you have continuously to remind yourself of what level you're functioning on and what is the significance of that particular level. Otherwise, you can increase affinities, enhance communications, show yourself a reality, and then act on it, which isn't the whole of reality. And not the total of your affinities has been displayed. All propaganda work of a political nature is based on this triangle. If you want to go to another country in the great days of imperialism and conquer them, the first thing you do is study their mythology, their social and religious traditions, and their philosophy. When you've got hold of those, you've got the ground concepts that determine their behaviour. Now, if you like to write those up on posters and say, "We, the gentlemen who love these ideas of yours, have come to release you, and therefore we are going to occupy all the posts needful to administrate the cash of this particular country." If you set up these statements first, the heads start to nod, "Yea, verily, those are our favourite ideas." And then the illogical thing, "The man who has just said he likes them must be a nice man. Therefore we shouldn't really stop him sitting in our chairs." And that's absolutely basic in propaganda. To subdue any people at all, you study their mythology, their tradition, social structure, religion, and when this is completely absorbed, you then have many, many points of affinity, and therefore a great power of communication, and therefore you seem to them very, very real. If you read Montgomery's book on leadership, you'll find it saturated with that kind of elementary trick, where on one page he talks about men as the raw material of his craft. The raw material. And he's thinking about them as material, just material, and he says so. But he's so straightforward because he said, "I'm an honest, straightforward man." And everybody likes an honest, straightforward man, therefore they must like him, therefore they must like being raw material. None of it is logical. He says he prefers the army because you've got to do as you're told, to industry where you have to be persuaded to do as you're told. And this kind of awareness in him makes him quite cheeky, because he is thoroughly aware of the nature of a conditioned reflex. On every page he turns in some stupid little anecdote for which his higher critics slap him and say he shouldn't talk nonsense in the middle of a serious book. And he's thrown that in as just a little stimulus for any stray, careless reader who will be delighted with the anecdote. He doesn't aim at strict logical accuracy throughout the book. The book is full of inaccuracies, inconsistencies, self-refutations. And yet it produces a general effect that he's a very, very nice man who loves humanity and knows it to be good raw material for high purposes. It's worth reading to see it and to look through it for the amazing number of inconsistencies. And it shows you a man with a very alert mind and a very low opinion of the readers that he's written the book for. But he does have the grace to say they are material. And if he said, "Dear reader, you are part of the material, and I, as a leader, must have followers, and this means you." The reply to the book, which I've written the title of, and I'll probably get Roy to have the right book later, it is called The Path to Followership, where all the qualities defined for a leader are written down and then rubbed out. So that if decision is a quality of leadership, then indecision must be a quality of followership. So if you want to qualify to be a good follower, you must be insincere, unaware of the nature of the human being, incapable of a decision, have no proper application, lack concentration, etc., etc., etc. And if you can say you've got all these, you are then ready for your diploma in followership. shortly we'll repeat it again. Do say at what level you're communicating, because only if you state the level can you come to an agreement. Most disagreement in science and philosophy comes from this simple fact that a group of men arguing on the basis of a five-pointed star, like the one on the flag of the USSR and USA, are saying we base ourselves on the use of our five sense organs. We are empiricists, extrovert materialists. And they're always arguing with another bunch of fellows, the philosophers, who use a geometrical structure which they assert, basically and openly, is prior to the appearance of the five-pointed star, prior to the appearance of your special sense organs, and rooted in the very laws of motion of the universe itself, the logos of the Greeks. And then there's another kind of thinking called Christian thinking. And in this, quite simply, the statement is, I and any passive being that I come in relation with. The vertical, the active, and the horizontal, the passive. In any relationship between two beings, there may be one passive and the other active in relation to any given concept or any given level of being. If you know this, you can be consciously passive, where you don't know the subject matter and thus acquire some knowledge. Or if you do know it, then you can present it. But if you know both of them, you will know that if you are presenting it, it's quite probable that the others are going to sleep. You see, the use of a symbol controls the level of the discussion. If we take the old swastika which Hitler borrowed, it is derived from an old glyph of the sun with its arms coming up and signifies revolution. If it goes around Medicines, it means revolution of an evil order, to destroy. And if it goes around the other way, revolution for a good purpose. By using such geometrical symbols, you can control the level of your discussion. You must say, if you are trying to lift up the reality level with another person, at what level you are talking. In terms of shorthand, you can say, I'm talking in terms of 5 point or 6 point, or on the cross, or if you like, on the swastika, although that's out of fashion. Don't mention it. You notice that the double square one is a Muslim one, and it tells you about the nature of the material world. It gives an eight-pointed star. The material world lacked on itself as a dialectic thing, that there are diversities at the material level. And another very great element for them is the moon, which is to remind you that things wax and wane. Every time you use a symbol of this order, you can help yourself to keep control of the level at which you're talking. You can refer to the five sense data, if you stress the pentagon in the middle, to the coordination of that data. And there's quite a difference between the two. Those scientists who believe only in sense data refuse to add it up. They refuse to make a hypothesis. They never make a theory. They say quite simply, let us collect sense data. And let us just use sense data. But don't let us formulate a theory of sense data, nor a hypothesis about sense data. Just let's keep using them. They're right on the tips of the star. Some others say we can afford to coordinate sense data because it accelerates the process of science.
Does that mean they don't make a decision on the tips?
No, they just collect data.
What then?
Well, there are some other people that are very fond of the data they collect and don't accept their principle, but they accept their data. Now, in the case of these pure geometricians, you will find that the top-ranking mathematicians of the world don't like merely accepting sense data. They insist that sense data are forms of motion and that the laws of the propagation of motion are geometrical, subject to geometrical analysis and mathematical statements. Fellows like Alfred North Whitehead and so on. Those people consider themselves superior to these people because in point of evolutionary development it can be demonstrated that before there was a five-sense orbit on the Earth, there was a sphere of protoplasm. which approximates nearer to the purely geometrical structure that they use as their basis. And if we go back to the laws of motion themselves and complete our wheels, as we have done so often, we can find that we have a mode of analysis of all things in terms of motion propagated from centres, and the motions from those centres overlapping and mutually interfering and giving rise to the sense data at the point of intersection. We can explain sense data in terms of the laws of motion. We cannot explain the laws of motion in terms of sense data. Now, if A explains B and B does not explain A, A is superior to B.